Are you thinking about getting your GED diploma? Well, here at the GED Pep Talk Center, we've got a number of pep talks that can motivate you.
Sometimes things don't always turn out the way you want them to.
You know that feeling? People look at you and don't believe in you.
You want some gentle encouragement. Then you're on your way to your GED diploma and a better life.
But I know you're probably just a little bit nervous.
You can find it in yourself to take that first step.
You can improve your future.
You can do this. I know you can.
You need to start pushing yourself.
Now get your game face on and take the first step towards a better life. Hurry up. Don't make me repeat myself.
Whatever level of motivation you need to get your GED diploma, we've got a pep talk that's right for you. Call 1-877-38-YOUR-GED or visit yourged.org for your pep talk and find free GED classes in your area. GED is a registered trademark of the American Council on Education, brought to you by Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Hey everyone, it's spring and summer registration time again here at Henry Ford Community College. Registration will open March 25th, and beginning March 11th, you will be able to view class schedules online through WebAdvisor. The first day of our 8-week spring semester is May 7th. If you're a current HFCC student or somebody that's just ready to get back into that academic groove, there's no better time than right now. HFCC has one of the lowest tuition rates in the state. If you're a current HFCC student, you can do all of this online. If you're new to HFCC, stop into our Registration and Welcome Center here on the campus at 5101 Evergreen Road. Or you can call them at 313-845-6403. So remember, Henry Ford Community College's spring and summer class registration starts March 25th. To review all of the details and for more information, visit us online at www.hfcc.edu. And we'll see you this spring on the campus of Henry Ford Community College.
Hey, it's Lady J. If you like being relaxed, kicked back, and enjoying satisfying sounds of jazz, join me each and every Saturday from 2 p.m. until 4 p.m. with Illusions of Jazz on 89.3 WHFR.FM, the only station that's still making waves.
Hi, this is Jawbone. You're listening to WHFR Dearborn.
Disclaimer: this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our board of trustees, or students.
You may listen to WNYC shows online or as podcasts. Maybe you're listening through our mobile app or tracking us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd like to know how we can serve you better on these platforms. Go to WNYC.org/feedback and register today.
Steve Levitt is my Freakonomics friend and co-author. He's an economist at the University of Chicago. One topic that he's studied for years from a lot of angles is crime. He's tried to figure out which of many potential factors have a big impact on crime rates. More police and more prisons? That's a yes. The economy? Mostly a no. Did the legalization of abortion help crime fall a generation later? That is a yes. He's also studied guns, gun laws, gun buybacks, gun crime. Levitt and I were working together in Texas on the day back in December that a 20-year-old guy in Connecticut named Adam Lanza killed his mother and shot up an elementary school, killing 20 little kids and 6 adults, and finally shot himself. As horrific as that was, as incomprehensibly sad, Steve Levitt, given everything he knows about crime, he wasn't all that surprised.
You know, I think my reaction was probably different than other people's reactions, because the thing that I'm always shocked by is how few insane people are out there doing mass murders, not how many are out there doing mass murders. And so I have sort of a sense of foreboding. I always expect there to be crazy people out there doing murders. And so I guess I probably wasn't as surprised as a lot of other people were.
So you're more surprised when there isn't as much mayhem in the world as there is the opportunity for mayhem to occur.
Yeah, the way I think about it, when there's one or two people out there a year who just go completely nuts and kill a bunch of people, then you think, well, why is it only one or two? Why is it not 8 or 10 or 15 or 20? Once you get that far in the tail, it seems striking that that there we know there are lots of people who are insane. We certainly know there are lots of guns, and that's a lethal combination.
From WNYC and APM, American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio, the podcast that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
On today's show, a conversation with my Freakonomics co-author Steve Levitt about guns. Now, the U.S. has a lot of guns. By most estimates, at least one gun for every adult. And we have a lot of gun violence. In a given year, there are roughly 11,000 gun murders and nearly 20,000 gun suicides. And then there are the mass killings, like the one in Newtown, Connecticut, that makes everyone rethink everything they ever thought about guns. Now, how many such killings are there, and are they on the rise? Well, it depends on how you count and whom you ask. Mother Jones magazine recently built a database of mass shootings, four or more fatalities, over the past 30 years. Not everyone likes this database. It excludes, for instance, all gang shootings and armed robberies, but here are those numbers. Since 1982, there have been 62 mass shootings with a total of 513 fatalities, or an average of about two mass shootings and 16 and a half fatalities a year. Now remember, keep in mind, there are about 11,000 gun murders each year in total. Over the past 10 years, those numbers are a bit higher, about three shootings a year with 26 fatalities. But 2012 was a very bad year. Seven shootings with 72 fatalities, more than four times the average number of victims in a year from mass shootings. So you can see why this topic has got everyone's attention. But here's how Steve Levitt makes sense of these numbers.
Yeah, it certainly appears to be the case that these isolated incidents of mass violence against strangers is going up. But I think you also need to put it in the context of the amazing gains we've had in the reductions of crime since the peak of homicide, that homicides are way down. They're down, you know, almost 50%, maybe even more than 50% from the peak. It's come down year after year after year. The number of people who are killed by guns is in the thousands. But the number of people who are killed in these sort of new town type of events is really, really a small piece of the overall gun violence. So much more gun violence is either drug dealers shooting one another, spouses or killing each other, friends and family killing each other more generally, or indeed killing yourself. I mean, of all the gun violence, which really is at the top of the list, suicides, gun suicides.
The fact is, though, that while gun violence isn't necessarily increasing overall, it's been relatively flat for the past 10 or 15 years after having fallen a good bit before that. The U.S. is more violent than most other rich countries, at least. There's more gun damage here than most other rich countries. Why do you think that is? Any thoughts?
Well, we have more crime in general across the board than many other rich countries. And more specifically, though, we have a lot more guns than other countries. So it's not the slightest bit surprised that when you have as many guns as people in a country, that your gun violence will be much higher than a place like the UK, where guns are incredibly sparse.
All right. So when you say that, one might immediately say, well, okay, if you want to get rid of the violence, you need to obviously get rid of guns, but there are some issues with that, right? I mean, first of all, guns are not perishable. Unlike Coca-Cola or a car, it doesn't deteriorate in any way. So a gun that exists 10 years ago will still exist today. So how do you start to think about, if your goal is to lessen the amount of guns, lessen the supply of guns, how do you think about doing that?
If your goal is to limit the amount of damage done by guns, then given the fact that guns are a durable good that will stick around and if taken care of well will work for 50 or 100 years, then the first obvious thing you need to think about is that you can't have policies that only affect new guns, right? If you have a stock of 300 million guns, it doesn't really matter what you do with the new guns if you don't do anything with the guns that are already out there.
Okay, so what are the kinds of things that are typically done with the guns that are out there? I'm thinking gun buybacks. What's your view on the efficacy or lack thereof of a gun buyback?
Gun buybacks are one of the most ineffectual public policies that have ever been invented in the history of mankind. So the typical gun buyback will offer, you know, $25 or $50 for a gun, or maybe they'll offer some, you know, there was one where they offered some therapy. You could get therapy.
Right. That was California.
California therapy if you turned in a gun.
Right.
But the fact is maybe 1,000 guns will be turned in an incredibly successful gun buyback program. And it's successful in the sense that there's a really big pile of guns and the mayor or the governor gets to set that pile of guns on fire, and it's a great media opportunity. But there's two fundamental problems. The first one is that the only people who bring back these guns and gun buybacks are people who don't want the guns in the first place. Most of the guns are inoperable. They are guns people inherited. They've just been, you know, not sure what to do with them. These are not the guns that are being used to kill people, right? Anyone who has a gun and wants to put it to a real purpose, doesn't bring their gun back for the buyback. So you get exactly the wrong kinds of guns. But more fundamentally, I think people are confused with respect to how dangerous a particular gun is. If I've done my calculations right, any particular handgun in the United States will kill a person about once every 10,000 years. Okay, so in order to prevent one homicide in a year, you would need to get 10,000 guns brought back in a gun buyback. Okay, but the thing is, you don't get 10,000 guns, and they're not the guns that are used to kill people. So the typical gun buyback program, I would guess, saves approximately maybe 0.0001 lives. And I think that's being optimistic about the size of the effect.
One of the questions that we posed in our first book in Freakonomics was simply this. What's more dangerous? If, let's say, you're the parent of young children, what's more dangerous, a house with a gun in it or a house with a swimming pool in the backyard? What's the answer to that question?
Yeah, the answer to that question is incredibly easy. And the swimming pool is far, far more dangerous than the gun when it comes to young children. So what we did is we looked at the number of child deaths that were due to swimming pools, the number of child deaths that were due to guns, and then we put it in terms of how often will a given swimming pool kill a child versus how often will a particular gun kill a child. And it turns out that the swimming pool is far more lethal than the gun, that a given swimming pool is 100 times more likely to lead to the death of a child than a particular gun is to lead to the death of a child. And so I know a lot of parents who would say, I would never let my child go over to the house of someone who has a gun in the house. But I've actually never heard anyone say, I will never let my child go over to the house of someone who has a swimming pool, when in fact that's completely reversed when it comes to the risks that the two products actually have.
All right. As we've discussed a lot on this program and elsewhere, people are terrible at risk assessment generally. And we understand why. Sometimes the math is hard, but also some things are scarier than others. And a gun is inherently frightening to a lot of people, especially the kind of people who don't interact with guns at all. So let me ask you this. In regards to guns, do you think then that reducing gun violence is a goal that should be put front and center on, let's say, the political agenda? Or do you think it's really not as threatening as it's being felt to be and made out to be?
I think that gun violence is clearly an important problem. You look at the thousands of people who die each year from it. But the simple fact is that there are no viable political answers to it. I mean, so in regard to your precise question, I think no, I don't think gun violence should be on the political agenda at all. I think it's so hopelessly convoluted, and the kinds of policies that people suggest are so obviously not going to fundamentally affect the problem that while there is a big problem, I don't think there's any way out given the kind of minimalist suggestions we're making. And so therefore, I think we should spend our time on other problems where I think we might have a chance to really make a difference. I mean, I think about motor vehicle fatalities, and we've had an enormous impact on motor vehicle fatalities. There are assuredly other policies, say related to drunk driving, that could, and seatbelt wearing, that could have a big effect on that. And I think for the number of lives you could save, per word out of a politician's mouth or dollars spent by politicians, is probably 100 times greater if we think about motor vehicle fatalities than if we think about gun violence.
Coming up, how optimistic should we be about gun legislation?
Anyone with any sense looks at the current political climate, thinks about the kinds of proposals that are being made, and accepts the fact that none of these proposals are going to have any real impact.
That's coming up on Freakonomics Radio. Freakonomics Radio is supported by LegalZoom, providing access to a network of attorneys for legal guidance through their legal plans available in most states. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but has been dedicated to the legal needs of individuals, families, and small businesses for more than 12 years, providing self-help services at user-specific direction. Information about wills, living trusts, incorporations, LLCs, trademarks, and legal plan attorneys at LegalZoom.com. Use the code FREAK for a special offer available to Freakonomics listeners.
From WNYC and APM American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
On today's show, we're talking with Steve Levitt about guns and the new spate of gun control ideas that are being raised since the massacre in Newtown, Connecticut. Levitt says that many of the gun control ideas that are being proposed simply will not work.
Well, I think the policies that can work are ones that tie heavy punishments to uses of guns that we don't like. So, for instance, laws that say if you commit a crime and you have a gun with you, regardless of whether the gun was used, then without any sort of other consideration, we add 5 years or 10 years or 20 years or 50 years to the sentence that you get. Those kind of laws, I guarantee you, will work. If the incentives are strong and they tell you don't use guns, then I guarantee you we will see the number of gun homicides fall and the number of knife homicides rise, but not one for one. That people will substitute away from using guns to kill people to using knives to kill people, but it won't be one for one because knives just aren't as good of a tool for killing people as guns are. That will work. I have no doubt that will work. It's worked in California in the past when California put mandatory sentence enhancements on for felonies that were committed with guns. But I think the policy has to be one of that nature, where you're not tying it to the gun itself, you're tying it to the use of guns that you don't want.
Levitt, let me ask you this. So we've talked before about the hidden cost of things, something as simple as, you know, free parking, let's say, which in fact generates a lot of hidden costs in terms of pollution and congestion, real estate value and so on. Talk to me for a moment about the fact that, you know, modern America is perhaps the freest society in the history of the world in which just about anybody has the right to go just about anywhere and do just about anything within some set of boundaries. And that in this very, very free society, that perhaps gun violence is simply one of the hidden costs of that freedom. And perhaps, A, we shouldn't be so surprised by it. And B, it's a trade-off that if we want a society like we've got, it will continue to exist. What do you think of that?
Well, I actually don't completely – I agree with the part about the freedom. But I think the fact that there are all the guns around – is really accidental. It's, you know, if guns were just being invented today, the treatment of guns would be completely different than the treatment we have in this country. So, you know, it's part of the Constitution. It's been interpreted in various ways, but I think that there are all sorts of things that you're not allowed to do. You're not allowed to drive really fast in your car, and you're not supposed to litter. And I mean, there are many, many things you're not supposed to do. And I think it's really accident. I mean, I'll give you another example of accident. If you think about why is it that alcohol and cigarettes are legal and marijuana is not, I think that, again, is mostly accident. If people had been smoking marijuana regularly for the last 300 years and alcohol had just kind of come along and been on the fringes, there's no way we'd say, you know, oh, alcohol should be freely consumed by everyone all the time. So I'm not after making this country into a police state. But I think that people are kind of whacked when they act like there's something fundamental about, you know, how guns should be part of society. I think it's kind of a historical accident that you live with, but I don't think it was deterministic in any way.
What about from the other side? Not people who are defending the right to have guns, but the other side, people who are defending their right to live in a society where other people don't have guns. I wonder how much you think that that's a kind of a repugnance issue, you know, that people who don't like guns don't just not like them. They find them repugnant, and so much so that they not only do they not want to engage with them, but they feel that no one should, and that people who do are by association repugnant. Do you think that's an issue?
Yeah. I agree with you. Because the people who don't have guns themselves, they tend not to hang out with other people who have guns. And consequently, they really are at extremely low risk for being the victim of accidental gun shooting or gun violence, because such a trivial share of the gun deaths are of pure innocence who are being, you know, slaughtered by people with guns. And so it just gets back to what you said, which is that there's something else, that either they're misinformed about the risks that gun pose to them, or they feel the repugnance. But for people who don't hang around guns, guns are almost certainly one of the least likely sources of death for them.
So President Obama, inspired by the really horrible killings in Newtown, Connecticut, came forward with a plan called Now is the Time, which is meant to curtail gun violence. And it's full of the kind of stuff that we've been talking about here that according to you, pretty much won't accomplish much. Let's say that the Obama administration invited you to become its anti-violence czar for the next few years, asked you for ideas on how to cut down on gun homicides in particular. Where would you start? What would you tell them, and how would you think about breaking the impasse?
Well, I'd start by saying no thanks. I've got much more productive things to do than to try to lead a committee like that. I mean, I think from the perspective of having either a big impact on the number of homicides or being cost effective, I think it's a really difficult problem to make any headway on. I mean, I think there are very expensive ways to try to have a small impact.
Expensive in terms of dollars, you mean, or in terms of
expensive in terms of dollars and time and everything, but really dollars. So, I mean, let me give you one example. So it used to be that we locked up enormous numbers of people into mental institutions. And I don't know if that was right or wrong. And it turned out, though, that we weren't so good at treating those patients. And there's a lot of bad publicity. And it is really remarkable. We used to have more people in mental institutions in this country than we do prisoners. And that number has now swung, you know, I don't know whether it's 10-to-1 ratio or 20-to-1 ratio of more prisoners than people in mental institutions. And, you know, I think it's probably true that most of the people who carry out these tragic mass shootings are probably, at least ex post, described as being mentally ill. And I'm not sure these are people who would have been institutionalized before they committed their act or not. I think maybe not always, but just in terms of a glimmer of hope, and, you know, I'm not saying this would be at all cost effective, I think you could revisit the policy of, are there people who are so mentally ill that they cannot function in open society, and should those people be institutionalized? Because right now, very few of them are institutionalized. Many of them are in the streets. Many of them are, you know, living with their parents. And I, again, I don't think it's a great policy, but at least it would have some hope of reducing this kind of gun violence.
Well, let me ask you this. In New York State, where Governor Andrew Cuomo jumped out very quickly and passed a new gun law, or set of gun law, called the Secure Ammunition and Firearms Enforcement Act. One component of that is mental health reporting. It requires therapists and social workers to report dangerous patients to the county. The definition of dangerous being, quote, likely to engage in conduct that will cause serious harm to him or herself or others. And then the county would help to build a database that cross-checks those people with gun ownership, so that if someone seems to be a threat and has access to a gun, then the state would get to know about it. What do you think of this idea? How do you see that playing out, Levitt?
Well, in principle, it doesn't seem like such a terrible idea, but it certainly seems like it's one of these things that could have unanticipated consequences. So, for instance, let's just say I'm one of these crazy people who has guns and is thinking about committing a mass murder. Well, I sure as heck I'm not going to tell my therapist about it now, because if I tell my therapist, they're going to take my guns away, they're going to lock me up, whatever. So, you know, to the extent that you think that this sort of therapy is at all effective in solving people's problems and making them less likely to carry out these acts, this actually could have exactly the opposite effect you want, which is it closes off the ability of that mental health system to have any influence on these people's lives, because they're going to withhold the information that might have been exactly the information that a therapist not charged with telling the state about the problems would have worked through with the client.
Mm. I remember when you and I first started working together and we started talking about, we knew we were going to be writing about crime and therefore violence and therefore guns. And we started talking about Jeff Canada's book, Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun. And it led to this conversation where we wrote, here, I'm going to read you, Levitt, a couple sentences that we ended up writing. It might be worthwhile to take a step back and ask a rudimentary question. What is a gun? It's a tool that can be used to kill someone, of course, but more significantly, a gun is a great disruptor of the natural order. I wonder if you could just talk about that for a minute. When you think of a gun disrupting, changing the equation of the way that people interact with and fight each other the way they did hundreds or thousands of years ago, at least, how does the gun as a kind of, you know, intervening instrument just change the whole dynamic of the way that people relate to each other or against each other?
Yeah, you might think that having a lot of guns around would be great for reducing violence. It's the same theory that works with nuclear deterrence. When you have a weapon that's incredibly powerful, no one wants to fight because the costs of fighting are so high. Okay, but why is it in the context of guns, we don't think about guns as deterrence, we think about guns as causing the violence? And the idea here comes out of Canada's book, Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, which honestly I'll say is one of the best books I've ever read in my life. If it's still in print, I would just encourage people to go find it. It's fantastically insightful. And what Canada talks about is that in the old days, in the 50s and 60s, when there weren't that many guns around, disputes would be resolved with fist fights or maybe with knives. Okay, and the thing is, look, when you fight someone who's much bigger and stronger than you, you know who's going to win. And if you already know who's going to win, you don't need to fight. Because if you know you're going to lose, why bother? Okay. And so actually in that setting, when disputes are decided by fighting, you know, with your fists, you don't have to have many fights because there's not a lot of uncertainty. Okay. But guns, okay, and this is Canada's point, guns really destroy that order, because anybody with a gun can beat anybody without a gun, right? It doesn't matter how strong you are, whether you're popular or unpopular. The gun basically makes it so that uncertainty of the outcome of the fight is immense. And then that actually has the opposite effect of deterrence, because now if anybody can win the fight, there can be more fights, because it's not like you've got a certain winner and a certain loser, which means that you don't have to fight in the first place. And I think that's a really powerful idea. It's a subtle idea. But one that is really at the heart of why guns are related to violence, but nuclear weapons have not been ever used since we did it the first time when no one had them on the other side to scare us off from using them.
I I'd like to hear you leave people with a thought about gun violence generally, for whether they are gun owners and gun lovers or whether they think that guns are the most abominable thing that was ever invented. No matter what camp you're in, when you look at the shooting in an elementary school where these 5 and 6 year old kids are killed, you know, no one can be unaffected by that. It's the kind of problem that's got all kinds of tiers and levels and incentives and all different kinds of people with all kinds of agendas. What's the way that you would encourage people to think about violence and guns when something like that happens without resorting to the knee-jerk positions that gun people on all sides of the aisle typically resort to?
I would just say that anyone with any sense looks at the current political climate, thinks about the kinds of proposals that are being made, and accepts the fact that none of these proposals are going to have any real impact at all. So if you want to have an impact, I think you have to go back deeper, and you have to look at the fact that if we're not going to get rid of guns, but you want to get rid of gun violence, you got to get rid of the people who are doing violence with guns. And by get rid of, I don't mean, you know, there are a lot of different ways to get rid of them. I mean, one is to parent better, to have society and indoctrinate people into more empathy and whatnot. I think those are the ultimate solution. I'm not saying any of them are easy, but fundamentally, that's where the answer lies, right? If you don't have people who have the desire to go kill large numbers of other people, then you don't have a problem with gun violence. And so, consequently, I think that's the dimension. If I were forced to start thinking about it, I would be operating on, given the fact that we have 300 million guns in this country today, and my guess is we're going to have more than 300 million guns in this country 100 years from now. And so you just got to live with that, and subject to that constraint, find some other way to get at the problem.
On the next episode of Freakonomics Radio, we ask, who pays for our highways and bridges?
The nation relies extremely heavily on gas taxes for transportation funding. So alternative fuel vehicles and advancements in fuel efficiency pose some real problems for transportation budgets.
That's right. When miles per gallon go up, gas tax revenues go down. So what happens next? How do we pay for the roads? That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Freakonomics Radio is produced by WNYC, APM, American Public Media, and Dubner Productions. Our staff includes Susie Lechtenberg, Catherine Wells, David Herman, Beret Lamb, and Chris Bannon. Colin Campbell is our executive producer. If you want more Freakonomics Radio, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or go to Freakonomics.com, where you'll find lots of radio, a blog, the books, and more.
WHFR and Metaphysically Speaking are teaming up once again in order to bring you our 5th annual Festival of Enlightenment Holistic Fair on Saturday, March 23rd from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. in the Henry Ford Community College Student and Culinary Arts Center. As usual, we are thrilled and excited to bring you this premier holistic event. This year's festival promises to be bigger and better than ever. If you would like to join us as a vendor, reader, or body healer, please call 313-317-6540 or email us at holistic2010@peoplepc.com. Once again, that's call us at 313-317-6540 or email us at holistic2010@peoplepc.com. We hope you are able to join us at this fantastic festival.
There are a ton of social networking websites, but one stands apart for a very special reason. This one saves lives. It's MatchingDonors.com. MatchingDonors.com links organ donors with people in need of kidney and other transplants. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. If you've ever considered becoming a living organ donor, or if you're someone in need of an organ transplant, visit MatchingDonors.com, home of the greatest gift of all, the gift of life, MatchingDonors.com.
Hey, this is Stone Perkins. Do you know what my favorite time of the week is? You guessed it, Saturday nights from 8 until 10 right here on WHFR for Five Gears in Reverse. It's an alternative music show that features new indie and even plays older alternative tracks that go all the way back into the 1960s. You'll find it all here, punk, blues, indie, ska, garage, and a whole lot more. So why don't you join me Saturday nights from 8 until 10 for Five Gears in Reverse. Maybe I could make it your favorite time of the week too. Until then, keep it locked right here for all of our cool shows on WHFR 89.3 FM and on the web at WHFR.fm.
This is WHFR Dearborn.
This is Philosophy Bites with me, David Edmonds.
And me, Nigel Warburton.
Philosophy Bites is available at www.philosophybites.com.
Philosophy Bites is made in association with the Institute of Philosophy. Guns can of course be lethal, and frequently are, but the same can be said about cars. Is there a better argument for controlling private ownership of guns than there is for cars? Many law-abiding Americans believe that they have a moral right to own firearms, even automatics. Jeff McMahon, like most philosophers, denies this. No surprises there. But he believes that philosophers should take the trouble to show the gun lobby why they're wrong. Philosophy Bites examines the caliber of his arguments.
Jeff McMahon, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Thank you.
The topic we're talking about today is gun control. Now, I guess the most trivial reason people give for wanting to own guns is for sporting purposes. They want to hunt, they want to shoot targets.
That's right, and I think that's a major motivation of most of the grassroots supporters of the National Rifle Association in the United States. In my view, these are not very strong reasons for recognizing a right of private gun ownership. Two reasons for that. One is that target shooting in ranges and clay pigeon shooting with shotguns and so on can be done without private ownership of guns. As the places where one can go and shoot targets or shoot clay pigeons could have the types of guns that are needed for that kind of activity there for rent at the facility under conditions of security. It's a different matter in the case of hunting animals in the wild for sport. But if it's right that having lots of guns in the country actually imperils the personal security of large numbers of people, then it seems to me that the trade-off between the pleasure that people get from hunting and the security of other human beings in the society goes very much in favor of personal security of persons. It's, in my view, rather hard to argue for a moral right to gun ownership on the basis of the pleasure that people get from killing other sentient beings. I used to do it myself. I grew up as a hunter. I know the pleasure of hunting. But we have to recognize the intrinsic character of what's being done when people hunt for sport. They are actually going out and sending pellets of metal ripping through the bodies of sentient creatures who don't really threaten anybody. And that's hardly a kind of morally privileged or protected activity, in my view.
But people do think they have a moral right to guns. They think they have a moral right to self-defense.
That's right. The main argument, I think, for gun possession in the United States appeals to the right of individual self-defense. And what sophisticated defenders of gun rights claim is that if the state prohibits private gun ownership or drastically restricts private gun ownership, they are actually, by depriving people of perhaps the most effective means of self-defense, violating people's fundamental right of self-defense. So sometimes gun advocates give the following analogy. They say that
gun prohibition or restrictive gun control is analogous to taking away someone's gun just as they are about to be killed by a murderer, thereby rendering them defenseless. And clearly we think that's wrong. That is, if you're about to be murdered and you have a gun and you can use it to save yourself, but somebody takes your gun away from you or holds your hands behind your back so that you can't defend yourself, they are complicit in your murder.
So that sounds like quite a compelling argument.
Well, I don't think it is, actually. What's most fundamental here is not so much the right to self-defense, but the right to personal security. Now, if there is a right of gun ownership as a means of self-defense, it's a derivative right. The right to own a gun is derivative from the right of self-defense, because the right of self-defense implies a right to some means of self-defense, presumably, or at least that's what people say. But if I'm right that the right of self-defense is not fundamental, and the right of personal security is what's fundamental, then the right to own a gun is derivative from a right that is itself derivative from the right of personal security. And the real question then becomes whether gun possession on a kind of widespread basis, that is, if everybody has this right to self-defense and the means of self-defense, you're going to have a society in which lots of people have the means of self-defense, namely guns. If that's a society in which people are less secure personally than one in which they don't possess all these guns, then the most fundamental right, namely the right of personal security, is actually being violated by people's possession of guns rather than protected.
So the argument is that if each of us has the right, in inverted commas, to own a gun, then all of us are made less personally secure.
That's exactly right. You see it in the statistics comparing gun deaths in the United States with gun deaths in other countries. When large numbers of people are armed with guns, everyone's security declines. It's rather like a prisoner's dilemma in the sense that for a particular individual, it may well be true that he's going to be more secure having a gun than not having a gun, whatever is true of everybody else. But if he has a gun and it's a condition of his having a gun that everyone else can also have a gun, then everyone's going to have a gun and he's going to be less secure than he would be if he didn't have a gun and other people didn't have guns either.
Well, let me draw an analogy with transport. I think I have a right to get from A to B as quick as I can. That might involve having a car. If we all have cars, we'll all end up getting from A to B slower than, let's say, if there were just buses and trains. Are you then saying that we don't have a right to own a car?
No, I'm not saying that, though I can imagine circumstances in which that could be true. The argument you gave there was couched in terms of efficiency, and even though it's true that we would all be able to get where we need to go more efficiently if we all relied on public transport than if we rely on private transport, the value of efficiency isn't itself enough to deprive people of their right to have a car. Partly that's because there are other reasons for driving than just getting from A to B. Sometimes people want to go out and ride around on the single track roads and view the countryside. But more importantly, if private ownership of cars proved to be far, far deadlier to people than the use of public transportation only, then I can imagine a situation in which it would be right to deprive people of a legal right to own a car. We do restrict access to cars and driving. We insist that everyone get a driving license before they can drive. We take their driving privilege away if they have too many accidents or drink while they drive and that kind of thing. So it's no one thinks that there's a kind of natural right to own or drive a car. Now, cars are dangerous. A lot of people get killed in car accidents. But the difference there from the case of guns is that most of the people who are killed by cars are also themselves car drivers. So there's a sense in which by driving themselves, they consent, at least implicitly, to this practice. They accept the risk. They assume the risk of being killed when they drive their own car. Now, I think many of the people, at least, who get killed by firearms are not participants in this practice. That's a huge difference. I don't own a gun. I wouldn't own a gun. I don't want to have a gun. My security is reduced by people possessing guns. If I ever get killed by a gun, I won't be in any way implicitly consenting to this practice.
So you suggested that if there was legislation, as in the UK, on gun ownership, everybody in the United States would be safer. But at the moment, there isn't strict gun control in the United States. So it would seem rational for each individual to go and purchase a gun. So in those circumstances, why haven't you done that?
Well, the reason I haven't done it is that it's not clear to me that the claim that there's a prisoner's dilemma here is really true. It's not clear to me that I would actually be safer if I owned a gun. There are some statistics that suggest that when people get guns in their houses, they diminish their security because they may use those guns domestically. Someone may take the gun away and use it against them. Someone may steal the gun from them. I don't want myself to make a contribution to this situation. Even if I personally would be more secure to have a gun in the house, I'm unwilling to increase my personal security in that way at the expense of other people's security. This is one way in which enough individuals who act contrary to their self-interest can resolve a prisoner's dilemma. And that's what I'm suggesting that we should do in advance of getting the kind of legislation that's necessary to break the prisoner's dilemma in the traditional way, that is by enforcing an agreement among people that they will all do what will make them collectively better off, even though each individual would do better, presumably in this case, by having a gun, whatever others do.
You often hear the argument in America, again, not in Europe, that people should have the right to have a gun because they're not just defending themselves against other individuals in society. They need to worry about the relationship between the individual and the state.
That's right. You hear this argument very often in the United States, and it is closely connected with the Second Amendment to our Constitution, which says that we need to have a well-regulated militia. There are two reasons why I think people thought that it was important for the United States to have a well-regulated militia. I'm talking about in the past now. One was that the United States didn't have a very effective regular army or professional army. So the United States, early on in its history, relied on a civilian militia for defense against foreign invasion. But the other reason that people thought that it was important to have a well-regulated militia was for defense against domestic tyranny. People thought that they'd just overthrown a tyrannical regime from overseas, and there was the worry that a homegrown variant of that kind of tyranny might spring up, and the best assurance against that was to have at least some people armed with muskets in their homes who could oppose whatever army the government could muster if the government became tyrannical. That's an absurd argument today. No band of private individuals in the United States is ever going to be any match for the army. People also tend to forget that if there are some people who are privately armed and believe that the government is behaving tyrannically, there are going to be other people who are privately armed who believe that the government is not behaving tyrannically. So what you're going to get is a kind of massacre among the civilian population. And that's no way to resolve disagreements within a society. We have a democracy in the United States today. We can resolve our political differences through democratic political processes. That's the civilized way to deal with these matters.
You often hear the cliche, it's not guns that kill people, people kill people. And it's true that you get other societies like Israel, Canada, Switzerland, which are saturated with guns, and you don't have anything like the number of deaths through firearm killings. So why not just attack the root causes, which are obviously cultural?
Well, there are a number of things to say about that. One is that attacking the root causes is very difficult. Nobody has a program for how to do that. How do you get Americans to be less violent? How do you get rid of the honor culture that prevails in parts of the United States? That's a very long-term enterprise. One way I do think that you can attack the cultural bases of the greater violence in the United States is, first of all, through gun regulation, gun control, and ideally, eventually, gun prohibition, or prohibition of private ownership of guns, because that's a practical way of expressing the social opposition to violence. If people are more violently disposed in the United States than they are in other countries, and I think Americans may be quite reluctant to concede that But if that's true, they will succeed a lot better in being violent and killing people if they're all armed with guns than they would if they were not armed with guns. One illustration of this fact was pointed out by some commentators in the aftermath of the massacre in Newtown, Connecticut. The man who went into the elementary school in Newtown with a gun killed 20 children, and he shot most of them several times. There were no survivors. But right around the same time, another man in China went after children with a knife, and he actually managed to stab 22 children, but they all survived. So that's an illustration of the difference between what happens when a deranged, violent person is armed with a gun and what happens when a deranged, violent individual is armed just with a knife or some form of weapon less effective than a gun.
These mass killings we get in America, they pop up with depressing regularity. You don't own a gun, but do you think everybody who's gone out and purchased a gun in America should feel some sense of moral responsibility for those dreadful events?
Well, let me begin by saying that the mass killings are only a tiny drop in the bucket of homicides with guns in the United States. But it does seem to me that people who own guns, and in particular people who advocate private possession of guns in the United States, do bear some responsibility for all of this. And in a way, that seems obvious to me. That is, if we didn't have all these guns in the United States, we would have far, far fewer homicides. And we have all these guns in the United States only because people want to have them. We could have legislation prohibiting private ownership of guns and putting all guns in the hands of the police tomorrow if the gun advocates didn't oppose it. This is one thing that I think law-abiding gun owners and criminals are both complicit in. They both want access to guns. And the thing that I think is disturbing about gun owners who are not criminals is that they are willing to insist on their own private possession of guns at the cost of criminals having guns as well. That is, they would rather that they have them and criminals have them than that nobody have them. Because the idea that only law-abiding people are going to own guns in the United States and criminal types are not going to have them is, again, fantasy. So the cost of the gun owners being able to keep their guns is that criminals are going to have easy access to guns whenever they want them. However much of a background check you could do on somebody, if a person in the United States wants a gun and there's a gun in every other household, people are going to be able to get access to a gun if they really want it.
Gun control is a really fundamental issue in the United States, but it's odd that we don't have many philosophers talking about it. There aren't many articles about gun control, very few books about it. Do you have an explanation for that?
Debates that are dominated by empirical considerations just have a lot less cachet in the world of philosophy. But there are interesting philosophical issues in the debate about gun control. The problem is that they've appeared largely in the work of libertarian philosophers who are gun advocates. They have not tended to appear in the premier journals or by the most prestigious of philosophers. So within philosophy, it's very much a minor little debate going on in a tiny corner of the discipline. I think that this is an unfortunate state of affairs. Philosophers have devoted a lot of attention to other issues that seem to me to be morally less important, for example, capital punishment, where the number of deaths that can be attributable to the practice are far fewer than the deaths attributable to gun violence. But another factor is that apart from the libertarians, who are a fairly small minority within philosophy, most philosophers agree about guns, that we should have very tight restrictions or a prohibition. This is an area in which philosophers take a view that is quite different from that of the majority of the population in the United States. And so it's hard to generate a vigorous debate within philosophy. You're going to be preaching to the converted if you publish an article on this in one of the prestigious philosophy journals. But I think it's time that we end this situation, that philosophers take part in this debate, because there are some serious moral and philosophical issues in the debate about guns, and philosophers are the people who are best qualified to sort those issues out properly.
Jeff McMahon, Thank you very much.
Thanks for this opportunity, Dave.
There are now two Philosophy Bites books published by Oxford University Press. Support Philosophy Bites and buy Philosophy Bites and Philosophy Bites Back. For more details, go to www.philosophybites.com.
WNYC needs your feedback. If you connect to WNYC online or through our mobile app, if you listen to our podcasts or follow us on Facebook or Twitter, please take our online audience survey. Sign up today at wnyc.org/input.
From APM, American Public Media, and WNYC, this is Freakonomics Radio on Marketplace. Here's the host of Marketplace, Kai Ryssdal.
Time now for a little bit of Freakonomics Radio, that moment in the broadcast every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is the hidden side of everything. Dubner, how you been, man?
Great, Kai. Thank you. Been thinking about you. You drive a lot out there in California, right?
It's L.A., baby. Of course we do, yeah.
What are you paying for gas these days?
Ooh, a lot. It's like it's over $4 a gallon.
Okay. So people generally don't like that, even though relatively we pay pretty cheap gas.
Yep.
The good news, however, is MPG, miles per gallon.
Yeah.
We are now at a point where we get more miles per gallon of gas than any time in history, about 24 miles on average for the U.S. car fleet. And that number, because of federal regulations, is going to go up quite a bit in coming years. So great news, right?
Great. Yes. Now, what? With you, it's always good news, bad news, dude. What do you got?
Well, let's go a little deeper.
All right.
Fuel economy goes up. It means that the cost of every mile you drive goes down.
Yes.
So people have an incentive to drive more, which can lead to more congestion, more risk of accident. But there's an even less obvious problem than those. Where do we think the money to build and maintain our roads all comes from? Here is Jamie Rawl from the National Conference of State Legislatures.
Okay. And right now, the nation relies extremely heavily on gas taxes for transportation funding, and advancements in fuel efficiency pose some real problems for transportation budgets.
If you follow the logic train here, it's people are using less gas because cars are more efficient, and then there's less tax revenues being raised to pay for the roads, right?
You got it. Revenues are hurting, but it hurts additionally because the gas tax is such a strange tax. Instead of being a percentage of, you know, whatever, 2%, 5% per gallon, it's a fixed rate. So the federal rate is 18 cents a gallon. States add their own state taxes on, again, a fixed rate. So because it's fixed, unlike, let's say, a sales tax, you don't raise more tax revenue when the price of gas goes up.
Mm-hmm.
So every year, what happens is gas tax revenues lose purchasing power.
All right. So this is one of those got to ask it questions, even though I know the answer. Why not just raise the gas tax?
It would seem logical. Economists have been many economists have been lobbying that for years. But politically, for whatever reason, the gas tax is one of these things that is just a no-go zone.
All right. So find me the Freakonomics way out of this then.
Let's go down a wrong path first, shall we? I hate to pick on politicians, but the governor of Virginia, Robert McDonnell, has an idea that seems like a pretty bright idea, but most economists would say it's not bright at all. What he wants to do is eliminate the state gas tax in Virginia and make up for those funds by raising the sales tax.
And that's a bad idea because?
Because a tax is most fair when it hits the people who should pay it, but leaves everyone else alone, right? But what Governor McDonnell is doing is flipping that logic.
All right, so hit me with your plan.
Well, there is a growing movement. I don't know how well this would work, but the idea is this: to tax drivers the way they probably should be taxed, which is per mile driven. So that way, you'd pay the same amount for the roads, whether you're driving, you know, a gas guzzler or an electric car that doesn't use any gas at all. Here's Jamie Rawl again.
At least 18 states have pursued pilot projects. And in the past 5 years, legislatures in at least 11 states have considered more than 20 proposals to establish or study state-level fees of this kind.
Yeah, you know what, though? This smacks of Big Brother watching me when I drive, dude, knowing how where I'm going, right?
People will not like this idea in many cases, I would say.
Yeah.
On the other hand, let me just say this. We've all gotten used to willingly carrying around a GPS device with us at all times, which is what a smartphone does, right?
Yeah,
we're also getting used to the ideas of electronic tolling, where we don't have to stop at the booth. So I wouldn't be shocked if we were to see some per-mile taxing in the future. If things get really desperate, if you really need to raise money for roads, we could try what they do in other parts of the world, which is this kind. Traffic fines that are indexed to how much money you actually earn. In Finland, for instance, if you get a speeding ticket, you are fined about 20% of 1 month's take-home pay.
Wow.
So, you know, the speeding fisherman is going to pay a lot less for his ticket than the speeding high-tech boss or radio talk show host, for that matter.
Yeah, ba-dum-boom. One cautions, though, that this is America, my friend.
That's true. Not yet, Kai. Check in with me in a couple weeks. We'll see if we're all looking a little bit more finished around the ears, okay?
Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics.com is the website. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
See ya.
Hey, podcast listeners. Over the past 30 years, women have made huge income gains, so they should be happier, right?
Women told us that they were happier with their lives in the 70s than men were. So we had a happiness gap, and what we have now is a new gap where men report greater life satisfaction than women.
On our next episode of Freakonomics Radio, The Many Ways.
Taylor. WHFR Dearborn.
Hey everyone, it's spring and summer registration time again here at Henry Ford Community College. Registration will open March 25th, and beginning March 11th, you will be able to view class schedules online through WebAdvisor. The first day of our 8-week spring semester is May 7th. If you're a current HFCC student or somebody that's just ready to get back into that academic groove, there's no better time than right now. HFCC has one of the lowest tuition rates in the state. If you're a current HFCC student, you can do all of this online. If you're new to HFCC, stop into our Registration and Welcome Center here on the campus at 5101 Evergreen Road. Or you can call them at 313-845-6403. So remember, Henry Ford Community College's spring and summer class registration starts March 25th. To review all of the details and for more information, visit us online at www.hfcc.edu. And we'll see you this spring on the campus of Henry Ford Community College.